Empire Podcast. This week, we are going solo with the man who would be Han, Alden Ehrenreich, and two people who are suffering a severe case of arrested development as they return for a fifth series of The Cult Show, Aaliyah Shawkat and Michael Cera. Plus, the usual movie news and nonsense on the only movie podcast that cannot handle another handle joke. Ye gods, please give me a break. Hello, Pod. I'm Helen O'Hara, and welcome to the Empire Podcast, which is once again brought to you in association with those fine, upstanding folks at Sky Cinema, the dedicated home for movie lovers. Later in the show, Chris will be joining us live via satellite. No, wait, dead via? No, that's not right. Alive, but not live via satellite, to highlight a couple of the movies that you can watch on Sky Cinema, just two from the 1,000-plus films available on demand, including a brand-new premiere every day. Chris himself is away on a top-secret assignment somewhere on the planet. Or is he? He could be off-planet. I'm not saying. He's probably cooking up a fresh hellscape of jokes for next week. So in the meantime, you have me, I'm afraid. This week instead, I'm joined by two colleagues of lethal cunning. First up is the man who the Spanish call El Furioso, and the French try never to call at all. It's James Dyer.
I like that. El Furioso. Yes, that's my new name. I'm okay. Going with that, definitely.
Oh, God. What have I unleashed? And then we have our token millennial, a man who makes up for an avocado toast what he lacks in ever being able to retire. Yeah. It's Ben Travis.
But I have lattes, at least. I can enjoy lattes.
Thank God for lattes. My goodness. Such a relief. So we do have a question this week. In fact, I put out a call for questions on Twitter and was inundated with responses, so thank you all. But this one seemed like the most timely in terms of the films that are out this week. From @talkfilmytome, asks, with Solo coming out today, the film, he clarifies, what other Star Wars characters would you like to see get the anthology treatment?
Well, that's a good question. It actually, where do we even begin? Dengar. I'm going to say Dengar.
Okay.
Because Dengar has a fascinating backstory. So Dengar, long known, is the shittest character in the Star Wars universe. He's the guy wrapped in a nappy who turns up to Darth Vader's call for bounty hunters in Empire Strikes Back. He's also, though, I believe, voiced by Simon Pegg in, I want to say Rebels. It's either Clone Wars or Rebels. One of the animated ones.
Right.
So he's had a little sort of late claim to fame. But apart from being just a bit shit and the Star Wars figure that nobody wanted, who incidentally, and I'm not even kidding, for some reason smelled of licorice. The Star Wars figure of Dengar smelled of licorice. I couldn't tell you why, but that is a fact. Look it up.
I will.
So Dengar's backstory is this. So he became a bounty hunter.
Uh-huh. A bounty hunter,
like Domino Harvey. He was a shit bounty hunter. He didn't find the Millennium Falcon. However, he was at Jabba's palace. You glimpsed him briefly. He was betrayed, as I recall, and drugged or knocked out or something, and therefore left behind when Jabba went to the pit of Carcoon.
No!
And I think it was Boba Fett who did it to him. So Boba Fett dies. Dengar lives.
Dengar
he lives.
That's the name of the film.
Dengar lives. Yeah.
And so,
and this is the best part, he retires to become, or is it, to reclaim his dream of becoming a swoop bike racer. And he gives up bounty hunting for a life on the track until a horrible accident leaves him crippled and unable to race. I'm genuinely not making this up. It's on Wikipedia. Look it up. And he's rendered unable to race. And so his dreams of being a championship swoop bike racer are dashed. And rather than sort of, you know, end in a blaze of glory, he retires and marries and essentially retires to the countryside with his wife.
Well, hang on. Okay. First of all, I need to clarify a couple of things. Number one, I only told James about this question about 2 minutes before we started, so he has not had time to look this up. He just knew that stuff.
There is no sheet of paper in front
there
of
is
him
no
with
sheet
the
of paper.
That's alarmingly true. In my defence, I was involved in the production of the Harnopedia that we did as a supplement to the issue, and it's possible I did some reading around it for that. But yes, I have an alarming amount of Dengar
knowledge
in my head.
Second of all, what's a swoop bike?
A swoop bike. It's a lot like the the bikes to have on Endor,
okay.
The speeder bikes. It's a lot like that, but it's for racing. And at one point, I believe, Dengar races a young Han Solo. So this was before, because he was a swoop bike racer once before.
Oh, so it could tie
so
in.
It all comes back
full
together.
Full circle.
Dengar was a funny one, because you'd always want a decent figure.
Mm.
And you'd always get Dengar. Like, whenever I was given Star Wars toys as a kid, I had like five Dengars. It's the one everyone bought. And I guess it's the one that no one was there. And all I ever wanted was the original Han Solo one. Like, you know, the one from A New Hope, Han Solo. Like, yep. I had the Best Pin one, and I had Return of the Jedi one, but I never had the Han Solo from Star Wars one. And so every Christmas, I'd wake up on Christmas morning, I'd open my present, I'd be disappointed, and I'd be left with one question. Do you know what that was? Where's the Han doll? Where is it? I need it. Help me find it. Where's the Han doll?
I should have seen that lining up, and for some reason I didn't.
I saw it coming, but it was too late.
Like an asteroid heading towards your view screen, it was too late to get out the way.
Jesus.
God. I'm done. That's it. I was really just setting that up.
Yeah, I thought you were somehow. Oh, wow. Well, do you know what the character I would like to see spun off was? This is a very tiny spoiler for Solo. This is a very, very, very small spoiler.
All right.
There is a shot in Solo that lasts about a second of a small droid who's having a good time, right? He's jumping up and down on basically a control panel, and he just seems awesome. I want to know more. That droid is the droid that I would like to see at the centre of a new Star Wars spin-off. And literally, I think he should be like Wall-E, or R2. I don't think he should speak. I think he should just be a little droid, and some stuff should happen around him.
There's another very minor character in Solo as well. Again, it's not really a spoiler, but there is a thing in a jar
yes.
that sings that is probably my favourite thing in the film.
What is that about?
It's just like a little blob. It's like a yellow blob. I don't want to know how he lives, or she, or it, or
sure.
however it chooses
we don't
to identify.
Indeed, yeah.
But I just saw it and I wanted to know more, like that droid. I was like,
It did. I'm not sure about the thing in the jar because it looked a bit sort of bad guy in Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles.
Oh, what, the...
Shredder?
Krang?
The Krang. Krang, I think I'm thinking.
Which one's Krang?
It's like
brainy,
a pink blob.
Pink blob, brain
thing.
Blob.
Thing. Okay.
You know.
I don't know Krang.
Oh, well, somebody didn't
I know Bebop and Rocksteady.
You know Dengar.
And I know Dengar. Oh, come on, give me some credit. I got two words for you. Beru Origins.
Ooh.
I mean, those are the worst two words. Nobody
yeah, they're not
wants
good.
To know that.
All right, how about Yaddle? You know Yaddle? Yoda's girlfriend.
I'm just going to nod. And
do you know what? I do. And do you know why I know this? It's because a friend of mine has a four-year-old little boy, hello, yeah. Corvin, and he has not seen the Star Wars films yet because he's a little bit little. He's seen some of the cartoons and the Lego Star Wars, but he hasn't seen the movies. But he has read the Star Wars encyclopedia thing, which includes Yaddle. So he actually, will go up to my friend and test her Star Wars knowledge, of which she has very little, and then explain things to her because he's learning his mansplaining early. and he told her all about Yaddle, and she asked me about him and and I was taken aback.
Yeah,
I did not know.
Do you know who Yaddle is, Ben?
I don't.
Why do you know how are you again? Yaddle is the I would say I can only really say a girl Yoda because no one knows the name of Yoda's species, but she's a female of Yoda's species who appears on the Jedi Council in The Phantom Menace.
Ah, right.
And as is customary, doesn't have a speaking role.
Well,
so,
they figured.
Yeah, exactly. George, Yoda creatures don't pass the Bechdel test.
As the token millennial, I'm going to make a choice from the new trilogy.
Yeah, of course you are.
So. Maz Kanata, I'm fascinated by.
Shut up.
No.
She is 1,000 years old. She's seen things with those giant eyes.
Oh, God.
She's probably had other liaisons with Wookiees in the past.
That's what I see in my mind. So apparently everything in...
Okay, that's alarming. But
not in that sense, but...
Maz and Chewie make a porno, is that what you're saying?
Well, now this idea is destroyed forever, so... no, apparently everything in her kind of cantina is stuff that she's kind of heisted from elsewhere. So her just like flying around the galaxy, Indiana Jones style, just finding cool objects, bringing them back to the castle, and then like hooking up with Chewie.
Wow.
She likes that Wookiee.
There is already too much Maz Kanata in my life.
I quite like her, but I'm not sure. I just think we need to get further away from the main canon with the anthology, further back in time, further forward in time, further sideways in location, I don't care, but there has to be a bit more distance for me. I haven't played the games, but I'm aware of the existence, for example, of Knights of the Old Republic.
Yes.
So something like that might be the way to go.
That would be fun. I want to see Major Bren Derlin get his own film.
And again, I'm going to need you to clarify.
This is John Ratzenberger from The Empire Strikes Back, because sometimes you want to go where every Wookiee knows your name.
I do think there's something to be said for these anthology films, again, being further off in genre too. So why not have just like a cantina set story?
Yeah,
like
absolutely.
Almost a bottle episode of Star Wars.
The other thing I've got written down is Caretaker Origins, and I would maybe see that as like Last of the Summer Wine, but in the Star Wars universe, where they're just before
with
Rey
fishing,
comes and like
a lot more fishing.
Fucks everything up. Yeah. They're just living a calm life on Acto, feeding the porgs.
Yeah.
Trundling around with those little wheelie things. It's a blank slate. You can do whatever you want with that.
The Adventures of Cornelius Everzan and Ponda Baba. I'd watch that.
Would you?
Yes.
Would anyone else?
Yes, of course they would. They're awesome. I mean, they're not so good in Rogue One, but they're generally awesome other than that. Well, okay, they're shit. But, you look, a lot of these characters are probably shit, but as I think we've all understood from Dengar, you can do amazing things with random backstories. You know, they brought Dengar to life, and I think Ponda Baba deserves the same treatment. You know, perhaps he's an opera singer. Perhaps we want to hear about how Max Rebo put his band together. You know, Sice Noodles, when she got over her kind of death stick addiction, you know, was on the ropes. A singer out on a lark, found on the streets of Tatooine, recruited to join the band. It could happen.
This you know, is suddenly taking off. So it's
Droopy McCool's arrest on drug offences. All of this could be
It's all sounding quite sort of the Blues Brothers with the Cantina Band.
Yeah, I think that could work. Max Rebo was the talent behind, never truly recognised, but was the talent behind that band.
Behind the Blues Brothers?
Yeah.
Well, he is kind of blue.
He is blue and may have a brother.
We don't know.
You know, they had a rival ship with the Modal Nodes, which
was
a lot like Pop Stars, The Idols, or The Rivals, or whatever it's called. I don't watch reality TV, but I'm sure there's one of these shows.
Hence that pull from about 15 years ago.
You know, the Pop Factor, what is it? The X Stars, I don't know, whatever it is. Yeah, no, this should happen. You know, ends in a big musical number with the two. No?
You've a little bit lost me.
There is a sensible answer to this question, and it is this, that when you do like origin movies for Han Solo and for Kenobi and George Lucas for Darth Vader, you diminish those characters.
Yes.
And even though Solo is a good film, and we will get onto that a little bit later, it diminishes the character of Han Solo. Not like because it's bad, but because you don't need demystification. We don't need to see how he started. Everything I need to know about Han Solo and his backstory is in that cantina in A New Hope. I don't need any more than that.
Yep.
And I think, you know, the prequels, for all their good parts and bad parts, they don't do Darth Vader any favours. And I just think if you take characters that have no emotional connection to audiences, if you take characters that we don't know a lot about, you know, flesh them out, you can make non-interesting characters interesting. There's no need to make interesting characters less interesting. Here endeth the lesson.
Amen, brother. So I think that's about right, actually, and I agree with that. So, hope we answered your question. Talk filmy to me. And if you'd like to have your question read out on the Empire Podcast, you can, of course, do so via Twitter, where we are at Empire Magazine, and use the hashtag Empire Podcast, or we won't see it. Facebook, we're also Empire Magazine, showing a serious lack of originality. And on email, we are podcast@empireonline.com. All right, time for an interview. And this week, I think we'll start with the two immensely talented and funny stars who got their big break in their teens, the Jammy Bastards, when they were cast as the Bluth grandchildren in the cult comedy Arrested Development. Since then, he's gone on to star in Superbad, in Scott Pilgrim, in like a million things, really. And she's had a hit run on Transparent. She was in Whip It. She was in Final Girls. And they're now, of course, both back for Arrested Development Season 5. So speaking to, I believe, James and Ben just now.
Just Ben.
Just Ben. James.
No, I looked through the window and watched him do the interview, but on account of having literally never watched the TV show, I thought it best I didn't get involved.
Well, I can recommend Arrested Development. It is extremely funny. It
seems a lot like it's a comedy, though.
Oh, yes, I forgot your abhorrence for humour.
Yeah.
Anyway, with no further ado, please welcome Michael Cera and Aaliyah Shawkat.
So I'm delighted to be joined on the Empire podcast by the stars of Arrested Development Season 5, Aaliyah Shawkat and Michael Cera. How are you guys doing?
Hi. Good.
Hey, pretty
Thank
good.
You.
It gives me
good
so much here. Joy just to be able to say Arrested Development Season 5 is here, it exists.
Yeah.
And let's kick things off. How relieved are you two to be on a press tour where at the end of the interview, the last question isn't, so is Arrested Development coming back? What do you know about the next season?
Yeah.
And then you guys have to say, well, I don't know. I think it's happening,
right,
but we haven't heard yet.
Well, probably people are going to ask about season 6.
Yeah, exactly. It's just going to keep going on forever.
Yeah, but I don't know. It's you get used to that. And, you know, it's just nice that people like the show. I mean, really, we you know, when we made the show, it was really like nobody knew it. And that was fine. I mean, we all like loved it and everything, okay, but it's nice that people know it now. I mean, it could have gone the other way. It might have just fallen through the cracks.
Yeah, totally.
Nobody would ever have found it, you know?
And the kind of home release of Netflix, I got into it when I was at university because I got the box sets, and then it was like one person watched it, and then we all watched
people,
it together.
I think. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I can't believe as well it's already like 5 years since season 4.
I know. Yeah, that's weird.
Was it a reunion for you guys getting together for season 5, or do you keep up with each other in the intervening years?
We stay in touch.
Yeah, we see each other.
Long walks and dinners every now and then.
But, yes.
For everybody else, it felt definitely like a reunion type thing. The last 5 years, in a weird way, felt like the longest, you know, in a weird way. You know what I mean? Like, because again, we never find out that we're actually doing it till like a week before.
Yes. Really?
Yeah, or less.
Although I went to LA to help
to write.
Brainstorm
but
things.
But it still wasn't
in 2015.
Jesus Christ.
So then I walked away from that thinking it's probably never going to happen because like a lot of time went by we had like a lot of ideas. Mm-hmm. I don't know if any of those actually made it into this series though.
Right.
Might have just thrown it all away and started from scratch.
Well, it got different too once the election happened.
Yeah. Sure.
Yeah, can you remember any of the ideas that you threw out there in that meeting? Can you remember any of
those? Well, there was a whole like story arc that ended up not really making it into the show.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I don't know if I can really describe it. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know if you're allowed to.
I mean, describing some of the actual plots of the show is hard enough.
What actually happened.
And everything.
It's like it was a while ago, but yeah.
And I guess I imagine the wait for season 4 didn't feel like a wait for season 4 because you didn't know that season 4 was going to happen.
No.
Whereas
this
time the expectation was that hopefully it would come back after a few years.
Yeah.
I think
and
so.
And as we were saying earlier too, it was like very early on for Netflix kind of, you know, it wasn't fully original programming, but it was one of the first shows that Netflix like, you know, made. Mm-hmm. And now they have so many original programming shows. So when it happened too, it was kind of like, who knows if we'll make another one of these? And then you start seeing all the other shows. Mm-hmm. And I was like, are we going to get to do another one of those?
Right.
Like, I don't know. It felt like watching Netflix shift so much and how it grew, you know, so
like,
exponentially.
These guys are going to keep making things.
Yeah. I'm like,
it's working
doing well.
Them. Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
So when did you actually find out that it was coming back? And what was it like getting the script through? Was it like you got the script and you thought, oh, okay, here it is. It is real.
I mean, I think it was the kind of thing where you don't know it's real until you're there shooting it, like until you arrive
totally.
And you're doing a fitting. You're like, wow, okay, we're going to do this. And you see everyone else. But because we started last year in the summer.
Yeah.
Like late summer in 2017. So I think, you know, it was kind of like became real for me a few months before that. Mm-hmm. I mean, they'll usually like figure out, you know, coming to LA and figure out your living situation and really, you know, starts to become concrete.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, then,
Sorry.
No, just like the scripts too. We did get a couple of scripts, but then it reminded me the most that we were back when we started shooting and being like, all right, this is how it works.
Yes.
It's like everything would change really randomly.
Yes.
And
day of.
All of a sudden they're like, we got to fit you for these like meth teeth and a wig. And I was like, for what? And then they're like, you'll see.
Yeah. Don't worry.
So it's a lot of, like the crazy miscommunications and just like the randomness of the ideas having to come to fruition overnight. And
just,
watching that process.
Yeah.
Being like, oh my God, they already built this whole crazy idea of like, you know, someone in a banana suit and a crane.
Mm-hmm.
It was just like,
you just have to like submit yourself to that. Just go with it.
You just show up. You're like, all right, give me this. I'll take it. Let's
right.
go.
Right. Let's just do it. Yeah.
And did it feel different making it? Because obviously one of the things with season 4 was that because everyone's availability and the format of that season, it seems like you did a bit of overlap, but then quite a lot of separate shooting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What was it like getting everyone back together?
It was nice.
It was a lot better.
Really nice,
yeah.
It feels a little more like how you remember doing it.
Mm-hmm. Totally.
The original series, everyone's there.
Because the last time we didn't even, like, we had some stuff together, but it didn't feel like it was in the same vein or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Like, we all had our own because it was kind of like each character had their own episode that kind of worked together. But this one was a lot more, just like the original show. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, did it feel like the original? Did it feel like something new because of Netflix? Has that changed the way that the show kind of gets made? And
well, yeah, it does change the production like schedule because we sort of block shoot the whole season instead of, you know, work on like this week, we're working on episode 7.
Mm-hmm.
We sort of just do the whole thing as like a big shoot, almost like a movie.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then the narrative episodes sort of get decided in post.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
So we, you know, That's just kind of a different way of approaching the work than we originally did, because we actually were like, you know, they would air as we were shooting when we did the original series. Yeah. So you would do an episode a week and then that would be done. And then you'd do another episode and it was much more linear storytelling as a performer. Like you knew more where you were. Yeah. Sometimes when you shoot this way, you don't really know the context of what you're doing.
Totally.
And it's, you just have to like get kind of informed right before you do it and hope that you get it right.
Yeah. Trust in Mitch Hurwitz.
Yes. Yeah.
He knows,
a lot of trust.
All the trust.
Yes.
Yeah.
And it seems like that was kind of the... what happened with this kind of remixed version of season four that like obviously it was all shot in that way and then they took everything they had and rearranged it into it. Those kind of 20-minute episodes, more like the original format. Have you guys seen the remix? How do you feel about that situation? Because as much as season four got a difficult reception, it's really interesting in what it was like doing. I've never seen a show have that structure before. It's like every character's a different episode, but it's all happening concurrently. And
looking back on it, I was kind of like, because I liked the fourth season. I thought it was really interesting. I was like, it didn't have the same feel as the first three seasons, but... you know, talking about it in press now, being like, yeah, it was, Netflix was still such a new format of being like, you go watch the whole show and we adjust to things like technology so quickly where we're just like, yeah, that's normal. But I'm like, only 5 years ago, that was not how we processed, you know, TVs and movie. Like, and now we watch so much in a different way. So I think it was like so smart, as Mitch is obviously, to be like, let's try something new with this format because like, in his mind, he was like, you could hop from one episode to the other because you see a character in the background. It was really smart. And again, just like very Arrested Development, like where it was like ahead of its time, I think, where people were like, what is this? You know, that's how the show was responded to when it first came out. But the remixed version, I watched a couple episodes and it is definitely like you kind of understand a little bit more what's happening. But I still think it was a really great like creative leap to try the other format, you know? It's like, why not? Try something else. He always is trying to do something different.
They're both out there now as well because the original version is still available. People can kind of, I guess that's partly the Netflix thing as well, like choose how you want to watch things.
And, totally,
choices there. Did you expect while you were making it, because it was just a different way of presenting the show, that there might be like a trickier reception to that season?
To the fourth season?
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, I don't really know if I knew how it was going to shake out. I think it was just so uncanny to be back and doing this show again that was kind of the focus. It's like, wow, this is so weird to be with this group again.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because that was the biggest time jump.
Yeah.
You know, it was like almost had been like 10 years.
Decade, right?
And we were like,
and it was a resurrection of like this.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, totally.
Show that died an early death, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And you guys have been playing these characters for like for so long now. What's it been like to like evolve those characters? Do you want to move them forward or do you want to go back and look at the old ones to kind of retain an essence of who these characters used to be? And is it easy to slip back into, or because you've done so much other stuff in the meantime, is it like, oh, I have to get back into this mindset?
I think it's slightly inorganic to like take 5 years off.
Yeah.
And then jump in and, you know, like guess how your character might have evolved over that time.
But also it's like, it's in the name. All the characters are in a state of Arrested Development.
It
so
is what the show is about.
When we get back together, like I remember coming back this season and finishing another job the day before and being a little like, oh, I hope I understand the rhythm and tone of this again, because all of a sudden I was in a gray wig and didn't know why. And I was like, gotta hop on the train here. But it really clicked in when all the actors are together. And like when we'd be in the hair and makeup trailer running our lines, I was like, oh, the pattern and the timing and the rhythm is like what slips into the pocket. And because obviously we've been doing it so long, it's a little easier than being like, so where is this character coming from? I'm just like, no, just tell me the lines. Like, I know her in a way that I wish I didn't so well, you know?
Right.
It's just like in us,
And yeah, like you said, so maybe gets another disguise in season five. Is it fun kind of getting to take on these other personas within that character?
Totally. It's so fun. I think I just became more aware of how many personas she's had over the years.
Yeah.
Like this time around, I was like...
a psychotic character.
Yeah, she just like hides herself. You know, I felt like I was like, this time I get disguises. And I look back and I'm like, even in season four, I was the guru. Yeah. In India,
or like
you know?
The studio executive.
Yeah, the studio. Yeah. Like she's always like hiding in these different people. But I love it. I'm like, it was so fun every day having like a new wig. Sometimes in the same day wearing three different wigs.
Nice. I mean, that's
I kind of lost who I was as a person, but I'll figure
that
out later.
Sociopathic.
That is
the character has become too. Also, like whenever you give advice in this season to me, it's always like
out of control.
Really?
Yeah, it's like, really bad.
You have no moral compass at all. It's fun.
And George Michael gets to wear the Living Classics pageant suit again. It's making its comeback.
Right. Yeah.
Was that the same one? Did they hold on to the original one? Did it?
It was a recreation.
Did you have to, was it noticeably
had to get fitted for it? Yeah, obviously it was. Yeah. I mean, obviously I wouldn't have fit into the original
Michael's
one.
Body has evolved tremendously. It's the last
this one was basically sheer nylon.
And the other thing we get an update of with George Michael as well is the Star Wars video, which is just one of my favorite things from the original series.
Yeah.
And now Star Wars is back as well. Did you watch...
With Ron Howard directing the Han Solo movie.
Yeah.
So too many references.
Yeah. Are you guys Star Wars fans? Were you bugging Ron Howard, like, can you let me see Solo?
I didn't know he directed it till...
Just now.
Yeah. I saw the movie and I was like, he did this, huh? I do like Star Wars. Mm-hmm. I'm not into it.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw the Solo movie recently and it's a really good time.
You've seen it?
Yeah, I saw it in New York. It's really,
cool.
Really fun.
Great.
But yeah, it has like the best, at least this, you know, film has like the best nostalgia kind of points to it. Mm. And I really like that aspect of it.
And if Ron was going to do another one, would you be kind of poking him and saying...
Cast us?
Like, I mean, what's the point in knowing Ron Howard if you can't
ask him for jobs?
Bother him.
Yeah, exactly. Ron, if you're out there listening to this, I don't have your email. Just get back to me.
Well, it seems like from Arrested Development, if you just walk down to Imagine Entertainment, you'll find somebody who can get hold of Ron Howard.
Right.
Yeah. It would be a very uncomfortable walk-in. You'd be like, yeah, hi, Allie.
Hi.
Come on in.
So with the Star Wars video, on the one hand, it's just you messing about and like swinging your arms around.
Yes.
But do you have to like actually choreograph that on any level? Do you base it on anything?
Well, do you mean this new one?
The new one and the old one.
And the old one.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, obviously it was based on, you know, it was a video of, you know, the original video of the kid doing that.
Yeah.
That was our take on that. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it wasn't too specific. You just kind of have to.
That was your version of it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Just, you know.
This one, it seems like you're explaining it more, right?
This one is like he's gotten good at it. I like that idea. He's like done a lot of this. He's like kind of good now.
were you studying the new films? Like, I need to steal that move.
No, I mean, no, because I can't do any actual moves. I mean,
was that you
all
doing
the nice
moves
stuff is not me, of course. No.
There was a moment where I was like, Jesus Christ,
whoa,
Michael.
Go.
High kick.
Get it.
I don't want to make the whole interview about this, and if you don't want to talk about it, that's absolutely fine. But
the Star Wars stuff?
The Star Wars stuff, yeah.
No, keep going.
No, it's a tricky conversation for us to have. Ron's so involved. So I'm a huge Arrested Development fan and a huge Transparent fan as well, and obviously the Jeffrey Tambor allegations have come out, and there's the New York Times piece as well that's come out just this week. The allegations and things came out after the new season was shot already, was that the case? And does it make you reflect on those experiences kind of differently? And does it make you think differently about what projects you're going to be going to moving forward?
I find that it this whole, you know, movement that's been happening, the Me Too movement, and has made me reflect in a personal way, for sure, about how sets are run and dynamics that I think a lot of women I talk to are like, oh, wait, that was kind of weird what happened back then. And I just processed it as being something normal. And I think a lot of men are also, you know, doing that. Everyone in general is becoming a lot more aware and hypersensitive to things. Mm-hmm. And it makes it kind of hard to know how to move forward. But, you know, I think it's definitely happening. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's changed... you know, we're seeing it happen, and especially in our field, where it's like the main conversation. Mm-hmm. So I think that's really, you know, important, and it's interesting. And hopefully it affects, you know, like with Time's Up to affect other fields, you know, for women who are working in fields that they don't have this kind of power and acclaim behind them. And it's, yeah, I look forward to seeing the trickle effect.
So one thing, I was looking at the IMDb trivia pages for you guys, because sometimes there's some like mad. I think anyone can put anything on there.
But
one thing that's on both of your lists is that you're part of the Interstate 5.
Oh, the Outside Tennis Club. Yeah, right.
Yeah, Jake Johnson would be
surprised. And like, have you played tennis together?
I remember when that went up. That was my like favorite thing.
That was Jake Johnson. So our friend Jake Johnson, who's a great actor. You know, one of the funniest, best actors working, I think.
Great guy.
Yeah. He made that. So we were all playing tennis together. There was this.
Yeah, Mike Langarano, another friend of ours, actor. And we would, all gather one summer. We were getting together all the time and playing tennis. Like doubles. And he came up with that name, and he was like, you guys should all check your IMDb.
It's next to the 5 freeway. Like, it's one of the loudest tennis courts in town. You can't even hear each other. You're, like, yelling at each other. And, like, the freeway's right there. You can't even hear each other.
Oh, that was fun times, though. We got to get back into it.
We were good at tennis.
We were really good at tennis.
Who beats who at tennis? Or are you pretty evenly matched?
Jake was the king.
Jake was great. You were really good.
I still can't beat him. I think I'm next.
I feel like I had a good talent for it, but it wasn't about winning with me.
Right. No, you're not.
I wouldn't necessarily.
Enough.
Yeah, I wouldn't clean it up at the end, but I kept up a good game.
Yeah,
yeah,
it's true.
And so, just to finish things off, despite the way I started the interview, is Arrested Development coming back for season 6? What do you know about it? When's it happening?
How dare you?
good question.
Yeah, I don't think
idea.
We know.
No clue. Idea. But be fun.
Yeah,
I hope so.
That's how I always answer.
Yeah,
we'll see. Whatever.
We'll see.
We don't know until Mitch emails us.
I think that, you know, as far as like the series, this season ends, it's, you know, as open as any other season. It's like it could keep going, I think.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah. We don't all die.
Yeah. Maybe it'll just become a virtual reality of Arrested Development. We're just like characters and you can interact with us any way you want. that makes it sound like we're sex objects, but no.
Right. Well, that's where it would go, naturally.
That's where it would go. We just become sex toys.
It's the natural progression of the show.
Well, I can't wait to see how season 5 unfolds, if that's where he's going next.
Yeah.
guys, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Nice talking to you.
Lovely to have you on. Thank you.
Right, time now for some movie news. What have we got this week?
What have we got? George R. R. Martin, one of his earlier pieces, is being made into a film, a book called The Ice Dragon, which, I'll be honest with you, I haven't read. And it came out in 1980, which was at least 20 years before Ben was born. So, you know, he hasn't read it either. But this is, it's called The Ice Dragon. It's nothing to do with the Night King. It is, in fact, about a young girl named Adara who befriends a rare ice dragon, which apparently comes in handy when an invading army of creatures arrives to mess with
her city. Hang on. This is all sounding a little bit familiar.
Yeah.
Has he only got one idea?
It's possible.
Girl, dragon, army.
Yeah. So this girl, who is not in any way Daenerys, has her own ice dragon and uses it to, you know, melt faces. So, joy.
does it melt faces or freeze faces?
It could melt faces, it could freeze faces, perhaps it does both. So this is a thing that's happening. And it is yet another thing that George R. R. Martin is doing when he should be writing the next book.
Well,
George, get back to your word processor.
Obviously, I have to quote Neil Gaiman at this point and remind you that George R.R. Martin is not your bitch.
No.
However, it would be nice if he would finish already, please. Thank you very much.
Yes.
Goodbye.
Yes, it would.
Okay. Well, you know, I'm all for more dragons, so I guess that's good.
Yeah.
Speaking of dragons, and indeed ice dragons, and indeed young people being involved with them, there were stills this week for How to Train Your Dragon 3, and the first details, really, of the plot of How to Train Your Dragon 3, which will involve, among other things...
Dragons.
Otherwise.
Training.
Actually, probably not. I mean,
Vikings.
They haven't really done that since the first one. Vikings also, yes, with strange accents.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know what point. Like, are the young people not old enough for their accents to have flipped from American to Scottish?
It's a good question.
Which
that's
happens
what
at some point.
Yes, because the older Vikings are all Scottish and the young ones are all American, aren't they? That's...
So when does Hiccup just, like, flip? And go Scottish. I don't know. We'll find out
next year.
It's been far too long since How to Train Your Dragon 2, and I am personally jonesing for another fix of Toothless. But apparently Toothless gets a girlfriend this time, or at least a love interest, in a White Fury. He is, of course, a Night Fury. She is a female of a similar species, and he gets a little thing for her. And meanwhile, there's a new threat, of course, that they all have to make, to meet. And also, there is a sort of a hint of a dragon... homeworld type place. Now, this is a bit interesting because in the books, I haven't read all of them, but I believe that the dragons all leave and go back to their homeworld at the end of the series of books that was originally based on. The books are, of course, not at all connected to the story of the film, like the most loose adaptation you could possibly imagine. So that doesn't mean that that's how this film ends. But I'm worried already that we're looking at an E.T. sort of an ending. And I'm not going to be okay. I'm not going
to
be okay.
No, dragons cannot ascend to the heavens.
I can't, like, honestly, like, I feel like about Toothless much the same way I feel about Captain America. Like, I can't lose both of them in a year.
Protect him at all costs.
Yes. just keep him safe and don't let anything ever bad happen.
What if
to
he's
him.
Got a beard in this one?
Oh my god. Well,
Toothless with a beard.
Well, we know he's now a sort of spoiler for How to Train Your Dragon 2, which came out in 2014. We know he's now a sort of king dragon, so he may have changed physically.
He's like the alpha now, isn't he?
He's now an alpha, yeah.
I'd forgotten about
that.
Yeah,
you see?
I like those films, they're good.
They're great films, I love them.
Speaking of great films...
Hey, let's...
The cast for It Chapter 2 continues to swell. Jay Ryan has signed on to play the older Ben Hanscom, who was obviously played by Jeremy Ray Taylor in the first film. But the cast for this film is filling up really nicely. We've got Jessica Chastain, we've got James McAvoy, Bill Hader, James Ransone, and obviously Skarsgård's returning as well. Mm-hmm. This could not be more exciting.
Bill Skarsgård, to be clear, one of the other Skarsgårds.
One of the others, yeah. Just Bill.
Every time they announce somebody for this, even if it's somebody whose name I don't recognise, I see a picture of what the actor looks like, yeah, and I go, I immediately know who they're playing. It's so
they've
uncanny
done
how
such
spot
a good
on
job.
They've got a lot of these.
Such a good job. Yeah, I really can't wait to see this.
Yeah, I absolutely loved the first one. I can't wait. And I've not read the book either, so I don't know kind of
you
how
mean
it,
the
how
film
it moves
formerly
on
known as It.
Yeah, no, I haven't seen the miniseries. I haven't read the book. So I'm very intrigued to see where the story goes from here.
The miniseries is very, very good.
The book is a lot better.
Long.
The book is super long.
I've got the audio book of it, but it's 45 hours long. Yeah, so I haven't started on that yet.
I think they have done the right thing to split it, the two halves up, actually, and do it this way. So I'm fine with them taking a while, though, to make this, because I need to sort of rebuild my courage after last time. So that's okay. I don't mind an extra little bit of a wait. Speaking of casts that are filling out in an amazing way... let's talk about John Wick, Chapter 3.
There's always time to talk about John Wick.
So we obviously have Chad Stahelski back for the third time. We obviously have Keanu Reeves returning in the title role because some things are not negotiable. But joining them are Halle Berry, Angelica Houston will be playing the director.
Amazing.
Yeah. We have Billions' Asia Kate Dillon, who will be playing, what was her name again? The adjudicator of the High Table. Mark Dacascos as Zero, who's an assassin. Obviously, everyone is an assassin. It kind of goes without saying in this series. Jason Mantzoukas is going to be the TikTok man. Maximum Derek, I think, yeah. To be honest, I think he's going to have to go full Pimento, who is the massive weirdo psycho that he plays in Brooklyn Nine-Nine. He went undercover and never really came back. It's amazing. Anyway, but also we have the Raid veterans, Yayan Rahian and Sesep Arif Raham, who are going to be in with the fight scenes as well. I'm just quite hyped about this. Obviously, Lawrence Fishburne, Ian McShane, Lance Reddick back as well. There is not a weak link in that list. I mean, it's John Wick.
The prospect of a crossover between John Wick and The Raid is more than I can handle right
now.
And throw Jason Mantzoukas in there as well. Every time I think about just his face, it makes me laugh. He is amazing. And his character, TikTok Man, is that an assassin? Is he like some other kind of... I loved in the second one that every time I'm watching it, I forget that Peter Serafinowicz is in it. And then Peter Serafinowicz shows up and I'm like, ah...
Yes, I'd forgotten he was in it as well, as the purveyor of fine weaponry.
Yeah, he's the sommelier.
Yeah.
So I wonder if TikTok Man will be some kind of gadget outfitter, or he could just be another assassin with a weird... There's got to be some kind of gimmick there to his name.
To his name,
he has a clock instead of a wind chime.
Yeah, he just like bashes you on the
head. Maybe he ate the crocodile from Peter Pan and now has a... clock inside?
It's possible that's a different
matter. I mean, they have been expanding the mythology, so if they really went there, they could just about pull it off.
I was trying to think it through, but I'm not sure there's...
This is going to be awesome.
There's
nothing more to say. It's going to be spectacular.
I mean, Keanu Reeves versus every assassin in the entire world.
Yeah.
Which is basically
what
where we
are.
What
would you want from a film?
Yeah,
I'm pretty much there.
Very excited about this. Speaking of international assassins, Liam Neeson's got another job.
Mm.
Have you seen this?
Yeah.
He signed on for the new Men in Black film, which... increasingly seems like something I dreamed and isn't actually a film that's happening. So this is Chris Hemsworth and Tessa Thompson as the UK branch of the Men in Black. This is right. I'm not making directing this. I didn't dream. Did I dream this?
No, that does seem to be correct.
Yeah, and Liam Neeson's in it.
They've both essayed British accents before. Mm-hmm.
This is going to end badly, isn't it?
I mean, look, I think it could be fine.
It could. I just, yeah, sure. I mean, so Tommy Lee Jones and Will Smith are not featuring in this one, and it's going to be awash with English accents, and all of that is fine.
The real question is who's going to do the song, because it still aggrieves me on a daily basis that not only did Will Smith not do the song for Men in Black 3, but they did get Pitbull to do it instead, which was a disappointing choice. And the song itself was not a patch on the original Men in Black theme tune. So that's the main piece of news that I'm looking out for here.
Sure.
I mean, Chris Hemsworth, can he sing? Do we know?
I mean, probably. There was a musical number in Ghostbusters, so I feel like it's probably in there somewhere, right? So.
Oh, maybe the Tessa Thompson connection. We could get Janelle Monáe to do it.
Oh,
I would be all over that.
Yeah, like
this needs to happen.
Go no further. I was going to suggest Celine Dion, just on principle, but now you suggest Janelle, then I think we have a winner. So if you're listening, please hire her. Thank you very much. And if you haven't listened to her album Dirty Computer yet, I highly recommend it because it's fab.
And the video, there's like a whole album video on YouTube with Tessa Thompson in it that is visually incredible.
Incredible.
And some other good casting.
Sure.
Well, it's not fully firmed up yet, but the it seems that, say, there was theoretically going to be another Spider-Man film, which obviously, close your ears if you've not seen Infinity War. I mean, totally up in the air, right?
Who knows? We don't.
But say they were going to do another one.
Sure.
The villain is looking like it would be Mysterio, and it looks like it would be Jake Gyllenhaal.
Interesting casting, isn't it?
He's never done anything comic booky before, or anything kind of superhero-y. And there was talk for a while of him potentially being a new Batman post-Affleck. Mm-hmm. So it'd be interesting to see, because I'm sure if he did take the Mysterio role, that would possibly count him out from any Batman plans. I mean, DC, that whole situation still seems to be massively up in the air.
Yeah.
We know for sure that Spider-Man Homecoming 2, whatever they're going to call it, will be out. It's coming out a couple of months after Avengers 4, so they're going to start working on it fairly imminently, I expect. I think he'd be amazing. The choices that he's made over the last few years, kind of Nightcrawler is the one that immediately jumps to mind that I just think is an incredible performance. He's an amazing actor.
There was a trailer this week for Wildlife, the Paul Dano film, which looks phenomenal. Got great reviews at Sundance, so check that out. That's on the site. But yeah, he's brilliant. I mean, he can sing. Do we need a Spider-Man theme tune? Starred in Sundays in the Park with George on Broadway.
Nothing could ever go wrong if there was a Spider-Man musical, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Do you two think?
There was also a Spider-Man musical episode of Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt, which I've had going around in my head since you first started this story. So apologies to anyone.
Did Kimmy Schmidt get cancelled? Did I read that?
No, it's coming.
Season
four is the last one.
And that's the last one. Yeah. Okay.
Which is upsetting. There was a little bit more franchise news connected with Michael Bay. So we know that Michael Bay is planning to take over Robo-Apocalypse from Steven Spielberg, which is probably the right move. He's also attached to star in a film, or to make a film called Six Underground, and that one's moving ahead first, and Ryan Reynolds is apparently going to star in it, but we don't know anything about the plot. We just know it's a high-testosterone mission movie, which could be said of literally anything Michael Bay has ever made, so it doesn't really narrow it down. What is interesting, though, is Transformers. They have pulled the seventh Transformers movie from the 2019 schedule. So Bumblebee is still due to open this December. Mm-hmm. It was the Travis Knight film, not Michael Bay. And then they were planning a seventh overall. I think that includes Bumblebee.
Like a sort of Wahlberg main series kind of one.
And that's apparently been pulled off the list. So that I don't know what that means, but it's...
I mean, it's interesting seeing... I don't think they've released much officially yet, but there were images from CinemaCon, I think, like promo images from Bumblebee. And the entire look around that film seems totally different to all of the previous Transformers stuff. So maybe this film is going to be a kind of real turning point for what they want that franchise to be. It looks a lot kind of softer and almost like slightly indie movie kind of feel. So there's a shot of Hayley Steinfeld with the old beaten up yellow Volkswagen Beetle that kind of look of the car, them kind of leaning, her leaning on the car, you know, big kind of blue sky. It seems like a totally different vibe to the kind of grey metal doom apocalypse, Michael Bay, explosions, dragon robots.
Grey metal doom apocalypse coming in 2019.
That's the true title of those films, isn't it? It feels a little bit like maybe they're putting off the next Transformers as a, I don't know, like an armistice, like a kind of a show of good faith in advance of upcoming peace talks, you know, de-escalation.
Sure.
Just like an act of mercy, really, I'm thinking.
Thanks for that, then.
I can't face another one. I can't deal with it.
The last one was such a mess.
Make it stop. We've not done anything to deserve this.
Well... I mean, we have.
All right, fair enough. We deserve it. I can't take it anymore. Although I do wonder whether Bumblebee, actually, I'm quite looking forward to. But
Bumblebee might be like Herbie Goes Bananas, but with Bumblebee, which
that's
is
what I'm hoping
fun.
For. I think if it has personality and character and fun and humour and not big grey metal death machines throwing CGI at the screen, then I will be happy.
Mm. In Travis Knight, we trust.
Yes.
We do. But I will say, the CGI in those movies is the best reason to watch them. The CGI in those movies is astonishing.
I don't think it is anymore.
I
remember when I saw the first Transformers, and I came out of it and was like, first of all, it was funny, even if John Turturro was in a different film. But I was like, this is the reason CGI was invented. Yeah. Like, I wanted to see Transformers smashing each other. And then... by the time we got to Transformers 23, I was just like, I am so bored of this shit. And now it's just like, for state-of-the-art CGI, you know, I'll watch Jon Favreau's Jungle Book. I'll watch any of the new Planet of the Apes series. Do you know what I mean? Like, that for me is state of the digital art now. And I think we've moved on from the robot smashy stuff. You know, you rewatch some of the Marvel films, and not all of them, because some of them have some effects issues, but some of them look incredible. Mm. And I just, now, the wow factor of the Transformers films is lost on me. And without the wow factor,
That's true. There's nothing else there.
Yeah. And I think, if I were Michael Bay, I would either find a way to escalate the visual spectacle to a way where you get that wow factor back, or, you know, God help you, find a script that makes sense and tell a story.
Let's dream big. Let's dream of both.
Yeah.
I mean, I remember my first reaction after seeing Jumanji, Welcome to the Jungle, and I was like, who knew? If you got a good script to start off with, get a decent film out of it at the end.
I'm 100%. I think I might have confessed this on the podcast before, but I remember, you know, when people saw Jumanji and were like, oh, it's really good. I went, no, I refuse to live in a world where that film is not two stars. Mm-hmm. And I adamantly refuse to believe that it was a good film because it's a remake of Jumanji. Do you know what I mean? There's no way this is a good film. And then randomly I watched it and it's brilliant.
It's a lot of fun.
It's so fun. It's
and
really
it's
well
the script
written.
That holds it together. Like the performances in
the
it.
The performances
great,
are great.
The foundation of the script is really solid.
Yeah.
The script is really good, but the chemistry between the characters, the comic timing. I mean, Gillen is fantastic. The Rock. I mean, Jack Black is amazing as Bethany.
The role he was born to play.
I mean, yeah. Anyone who hasn't seen that, do watch it. I now rue the day that I turned down going on set of that in Hawaii and sent John instead, where
what?
He befriended The Rock and got given tequila.
Oh, yeah, that was awful.
Yeah.
I'm still bitter I didn't get sent on that one, but you know, that's fine. It's fine. Before we leave news, we should also discuss Watchmen. There's been a lot of talk about that this week. Damon Lindelof and HBO obviously pushing it ahead with their planned series.
Did you read Damon's statement, which felt a lot like the Sermon on the Mount? There was much talk of testaments and
it's
gospels.
Very biblical, isn't it?
It was. I'm not sure I really understood it. I love Damon Lindelof. I think it's fantastic.
In fact, he said those old 12 issues are our Old Testament. When the New Testament came along, it did not erase what came before it. Creation, the Garden of Eden, Abraham and Isaac, the flood. It all happened, and so it will be with Watchmen.
Amen.
So.
Wow. I mean, it kind of leaves atheists and non-Christians out in the cold.
We're like, what?
Know?
So, just to clarify, this is going to be a contemporary series that follows on from the story of Watchmen without retreading it.
Indeed.
But we'll tweak what happened, I guess.
I mean, I guess. But we do also have some casting for the pilot. Regina King appears to be the lead, which is great news. Don Johnson's in there, Tim Blake Nelson, Louis Gossett Jr., Adelaide Clements, and Andrew Howard. So not a bad lineup, I think.
It bothers me that there seems to be a sort of a growing sense of belief that Zack Snyder's Watchmen film wasn't very good. And that was not the case. That film is great. And I stand by that. It looks great, sounds great, it is great. And also, it's a very hard thing to adapt. I think he did a decent job.
I think I would agree with the second part and not the first. I think it's a very hard thing to adapt, and he did a decent job. And I don't think it's a great film. Because I don't think it's adaptable. I don't think it is.
I really enjoyed it. I don't enjoy, like, they cut in the, was it the black... What's the
Black Freighter
stuff? Mm-hmm. That was a weird thing to do for that special edition release. That wasn't necessary. But I really liked it, and I thought they made, like, the big change they did make, I think, was a necessary one, and I think that was a smart move. But I love the feel of it, like the texture of it. Mm-hmm. I mean, all of Snyder's film, well, no, let me retread. A lot of Snyder's earlier films have an incredible sort of texture to them. You know, 300, even Sucker Punch, for all its nonsense, looks and sounds beautiful. And I think Watchmen is a film that, for me, narratively holds together, but is sumptuous to look at and listen to. It is all things. But then I must admit, I came to Watchmen quite late. Like, I don't have this, you know, in Alan Moore we trust, oh, it cannot be touched, reverence for that. Yeah. So I kind of just took the film for what it was.
Alan Moore is a bit weird. Like, he doesn't like adaptations of his own work, but for most of the last few years, he's been playing with other people's characters. Mm-hmm. You know, Lost Girls and League of Extraordinary Gentlemen and all the rest. Like, so, I don't know. I feel like there's maybe room there to do something with it. And hopefully this will be great. That's probably all the big news, I think.
We've got this far in, and in a week when Chris is off and Helen's in control, and we haven't mentioned Lin-Manuel Miranda.
That's true.
So,
that is true.
I mean, we mentioned dragons. We started with dragons, but yes, you're right.
We
please
can
bookend tell me
it with
more.
Your favourite things. So before Hamilton, there was In the Heights, which is his other Tony Award-winning musical, set in the Washington Heights area of New York, at the top of Manhattan.
Where he grew up. Yeah.
Yes, and it's... there's a film adaptation that's been in the works for a long time. So I think initially Universal had the rights, and then the Weinstein Company bought the rights to it. And then now that everything has happened and Weinstein is going into bankruptcy, the rights have been up for grabs. So it sounds like there was a bit of a bidding war between various studios who all wanted to get a hand on it, because now in a post-Hamilton world, a film adaptation of In the Heights seems like a fantastic idea.
Yeah.
So in the end, it looks like it's Warner Brothers who have got the rights to In the Heights, and they've got a director attached, which is John M. Chu of Step Up to the Streets, Step Up 3D.
In many ways, the best of the step-ups.
Step Up to the Streets is genuinely hilarious. I love it. And the dancing
form with
scenes
the kind
are
of,
incredible.
Yeah, the dancing and the... So In the Heights is quite a different vibe to Hamilton. It's kind of it's still hip-hop sort of elements, but with kind of salsa and... it's in a kind of Latino community in Manhattan, set over the 4th of July weekend in a sweltering heat wave and a blackout, and the kind of pressures of gentrification of the different generations living in the area. And at the centre of it is Usnavi, who is this character who has to decide whether he wants to stay in Washington Heights and look after this little bodega that he's running with his cousin, or whether he wants to go back to his roots and head back to the Dominican Republic. And it's a really fun show, lots of really upbeat numbers. And with Hamilton still being such a big deal and still making its way around the world, it's going to be a long, long time before there'll be an adaptation of that while people are still flocking to the theatres. But hopefully we'll get an In the Heights film within the next couple of years.
Yeah, that's exciting. I think Hamilton, they're probably right to wait because, well, Lin-Manuel Miranda himself has said that if he looked back at most of his favourite musical films, and most of them were made at least a decade and usually 20 years after the musical. Mm-hmm. So he feels like that period, that gap, is kind of important to making a really good adaptation. And who are we to argue with him?
And it's about a decade since In the Heights.
Since In the Heights,
was on Broadway.
2008, right? Mm-hmm, so. Yeah. So exciting, exciting times for, well, let's face it, me. So hurrah. Okay, I think is that all the news? Are we done? Are we done?
I think
we're done,
so.
Pretty much. So, time for our next interview. It's another disgustingly young and talented person who I think I'm right in saying was last on this podcast for teen movie Beautiful Creatures. Is that right? Since then, he's obviously worked alongside everyone, basically. He's worked alongside Kate Blanchett. He's worked for Park Chan-wook, Nicole Kidman. He stole scenes from basically everyone in the Coen Brothers' Hail Caesar. He is the absolute MVP in that. And he has basically just done brilliant work consistently. He tackled, I think it's fair to say, his toughest role yet this week when he tried to capture the swagger and charisma of a young Harrison Ford in Solo. And you know what? He's actually not half bad. So, talking to James and Nick, is that
talking
correct?
To me and Nick, where we ask a very special question just for Helen.
Thank you so much. That's right. This is literally my podcast. We've got all of my favourite things.
We've got everything. We've had Lin-Manuel mentioned.
We've had
Alden Ehrenreich talking about...
Supernatural.
Supernatural.
So enjoy. Please, here is Alden Ehrenreich.
A very warm welcome to Alden Ehrenreich to
Thank
the Empire
much.
Podcast. How are you?
I'm good. Yeah.
How's your solo tour going?
It's going really well. It's really nice. You know, we worked on the movie for, I don't know, 7, 8, 9 years or something. That's not really true, but like a couple years. And it feels so great to finally get to show it to people.
Should we be worrying that Harrison Ford will crash this interview at some point?
No, I don't think so. But somebody said it in an interview, like, do you ever worry about who's going to surprise you next? And I thought, well, I wasn't worried until you said that. Now, you know, we'll see.
So this is why you're cunningly positioned facing the door.
That's right. Yeah. Stay. Yeah.
All angles
watching
covered.
My back. Yeah.
So, I mean, how did you first meet Harrison? Because you met up with him before you did this, just to kind of get a layout.
Yeah. You know, the main thing for me is we were like kind of about to start shooting and no one had really reached out to him in that way. And so I just didn't feel right to go in without having talked to him. So we had lunch and he was just remarkably, I met him in his airplane hangar and sat with him with five of his planes, like five airplanes. In a semicircle around us. And then he drove to lunch and, you know, he was just super supportive and gracious about the whole thing. And then as you saw in that video, he's seen the movie and loves it, which means the world to me and everybody else that's working on this. It's such a huge deal. It's sort of like there's like the whole world and then, you know, what Harrison thinks.
Yeah.
And those are sort of the two boxes.
He's the important audience.
That's right, him. And then also George Lucas, you know, really likes the movie too. And that meant a huge deal because he created all this, you know, like he made this up. And so we're all, you know, have a huge debt of gratitude to him.
Did you meet up with George beforehand or?
He visited set very briefly while we were shooting. And then I got to sit down with him, I think a couple weeks ago at Skywalker Ranch and talk to him for a while.
What was that like?
Awesome.
It's like meeting God, right?
Yeah. I mean, it's so cool. And he's really thoughtful about it and he's brilliant. You know, he's a brilliant guy. He's got this museum about, you know, narrative art, which is not something I'd ever really understood, but you know, like, comic books or Norman Rockwell paintings, like images that tell a story and help us determine what our values are and what our aspirations are and how you kind of can't do something unless you can imagine it, and helping people imagine lives for themselves. I'm sure he could articulate this way better than I can, but it was interesting.
And they have a Yoda fountain.
They do have a Yoda fountain.
Photos.
Yeah, that's awesome. Right. Yeah, definitely. There's a lot of like, you're very aware you're in a Star Wars. This is the house that Star Wars built.
Did you get to wander around the archive at the ranch?
Yes.
Yes.
I went in and I saw the original blaster, which is slightly smaller than mine.
Is it?
Yeah. I saw all the lightsabers, which was pretty cool. I saw the original model of the Falcon. I put Indiana Jones's hat on, which not fit me at all. It looked like a little baby hat on me or something, because I have a huge head. And it was really awesome. It was really cool. It was, in a way, seeing the Indiana Jones stuff was even more exciting because I was kind of prepped for the Star Wars stuff.
Yeah.
And then I hadn't realized I would also see all the jackets and Short Round's hat and
the Ark of the Covenant.
Things. Yeah, exactly.
Don't
all that stuff is there. Yeah,
you weren't tempted to ask for a crack of the whip.
No, no. No. I saw it. It was in a box and I wasn't feeling like.
Probably need training.
That's right, probably.
Well, you're set up now. Surely you're a shoo-in for the next indie film. As the you're now the official new Harrison Ford.
I guess so. I don't know. That's like, yeah, maybe. I don't know.
Should have this contractual.
This is a terrible question, but how is your woodwork? Because obviously Harrison was a carpenter before
Nearly as good as his. You know, I actually have seen, he did the carpentry on Francis Ford Coppola's office in San Francisco, and it is spectacular. I mean, it's really beautiful. I built a couple little things and a wood thing in my house and refinished some chairs and some stuff like that, but not a lot.
small coffee table, maybe.
Yeah. So we had built a bench, which is pretty easy.
It's good.
It's easy.
We had Harrison on the podcast a few years ago.
Oh, really?
He told us that he fitted a kitchen for Jim Morrison at one point.
Really?
Which is amazing.
God.
Yeah.
I mean, like, it's like 70s was a cool time to be a carpenter, I guess. Yeah. He'd worked for Joan Didion, and I mean, it's pretty cool.
It's carpenter to the stars.
Yeah.
Speaking of stars, you get to act with everyone's favorite Wookiee.
Yes.
And a question that I meant to ask you is, does he speak the lines in English on set?
Most of the time what he does is kind of a version of it where he'll go like, I don't want to go. You know, he'll sort of do the voice but also the words at the same time. Yeah, yeah. And so you get what he's saying and then that. And then sometimes you're doing a scene and like, you know, me and Woody will be having a dialogue scene and it's like on my coverage or Woody's coverage and something, and Jonas will do his lines in the background, but sometimes that's just like in the middle of our lines going like, and it's kind of like, I appreciate it, but like, you don't need to do it right now because both of us start laughing and then it's really, you know, it's really hard to keep going with the scene.
Yeah.
Does he have like a team of people with giant combs following him around?
He really does.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. Well, there's, so the coolest place to go in the Star Wars universe really is the Creature Shop, which is, you know, Santa's workshop. It is all these incredible artists at the top of their field building every day the kind of craziest things they can possibly imagine. And then there's the Wookiee room, which I think is like 14 women sewing individual yak hairs into these Wookiee suits. And Maria, who's really wonderful and is kind of the head Wookiee person and is tall and you know, like, looks after him. They shampoo the suit so it smells really good, and they're constantly sort of like grooming it and, you know, working on the head and everything like that. It's really kind of incredible.
See, that's the thing I wonder, because if it's yak hair, you do wonder whether there's a certain pungency to chewing.
Yes,
when you're around him.
Yes. Well, when he's doing stunts and sweating and stuff, it's not great. But for the most part, it actually smells wonderful because it's like a kind of very clean rug.
Yeah. This is what I was wondering. If I had a Wookiee around me, I think I'd want to hug it the whole time.
Yeah.
Is that a
yeah, you definitely do that. And Jonas is kind of a master at photo ops. You know, like, he knows how to use that suit in every conceivably funny way he can use it, and, you know, like sprawling out like a Baywatch model, or, you know, like whatever it is, doing rap stuff, or, you know, he's really good with the suit, and it is hard not to crack up.
I'd just imagine a line of cast and crew just queuing up to get a motivational hug at lunchtime.
Exactly. Or, you know,
yeah.
So was meeting Chewie, I mean, what was the peak geek moment for you? Like, what was the bit that most made you get in touch with your inner fanboy?
Yeah, I think the main thing is really being in the cockpit of the Falcon and flying it. I think actually, you know, the first thing is you sit down there and you can't believe you're really sitting there. And then one of the really cool things about it is that in front of the ship is a screen that wraps around the ship.
Yeah.
And projects all the space that we're actually flying through. So when I'm looking out the windshield, I'm really looking at space and us and all the different things we're trying to avoid, or the ships or whatever it is. And so there's kind of that first blush of seeing it and how exciting it is to actually be there. And then the cooler feeling is a couple months into it, when you've been shooting on and you know where the buttons are, you know where the yoke is, you know what the seat feels like, and you feel like, okay, it's my ship now. Yeah.
Is that screen, was that Ron's edition, is that a new thing? Because they didn't.
It is a new thing. This is the first film, I think, that they've done it on. It was not Ron. I think it was partially Bradford Young, the cinematographer, because he was lighting us with that. So it's a much more organic way of having us lit.
So that's the reason for it, so that you see them.
I think that's the main reason. It's not primarily there for the actors, but it does have such a wonderful positive effect for all of us.
Yeah, it's like being at Disney World.
That's right. It seriously is. And then the ship you're in is on a gimbal and actually shakes and moves. And, you know, it is like the ultimate Disneyland experience all day, every day.
Yeah.
It's also hot as a mother. So Chewie is the person who really, you stick a leaf blower in his mouth between takes to try to cool him down.
And do you actually know what all those buttons do? At the start of the shoot, are you given like a giant instruction manual for the Millennium Falcon, or do you just press
whichever? It's loose, you know, like I like to do that kind of stuff, so it's loose, but we, you know, we have some Royal Air Force guys there. I guess here I can say RAF and you'll know what I'm talking about. We had somebody on set every time we were flying any ship. And I spent a good amount of time with them or in the speeder, you know, going through what everything does, because
you know, it's just, to me, it's helpful. I think for the most part, most of the time, people are just flipping buttons, but I enjoy doing that kind of thing.
Yeah. It feels like the kind of thing Pablo Hidalgo would be going, I think you'll find that's the thrust of there.
That's right. Well, there is, this is some deep cut Star Wars exclusive nerd stuff.
Excellent.
There is a difference in which direction you move the levers for light speed.
Yeah.
There's some discrepancy in the original films between whether you push it forward like a plane or if you pull it back. Or yes. Wait, I don't remember which one. I think a plane is forward. But yeah, it goes back and forth, and so you'd think that that's like a setting, maybe that, you know, maybe Lando has a different way of doing it than Han or something.
It's customized.
They said, customized. I think, on the original film that the switches and stuff, they weren't spring loaded. Like they would gradually sort of like ease back into their position. They wouldn't stay flipped.
Oh, okay.
So you couldn't stay on right. them. Nothing stayed in the right position.
Yeah.
This one's slightly better constructed.
I think it's slightly better. There's some real buttons there, and I also broke a good amount of the ship. I broke the yoke. I broke the buttons. I mean, it, almost in every take, because you're yelling and you're flying and you're hitting it, and they're very well made, but they can only take so much abuse.
Yeah, and obviously Harrison has become a real life flyboy.
That's right.
That's a word I can
That's
use.
That's right. Yeah.
Is that something you're tempted to pursue or have
I
a go
never
at?
Was, and then I get how that kind of you get the bug from doing one of these movies a little bit. You know, I went on a plane during the prep period and sat in the cockpit with a couple pilots, and it was really kind of cool. And I kind of get why you would want to do that. I just took a plane ride. I went to visit Coppola, who did my first movie with, and he has a tiny, tiny metal plane that we flew to Napa on, which was kind of a thrill.
Who was flying?
He has two pilots.
Okay, so it wasn't him.
For him. No,
okay.
No, it wasn't him.
Just an image no, of Harrison, helicopter squadron.
You know, Harrison flies like, I don't know, 3-4 times a week. He's flying constantly.
Flies, crashes, the whole
That's
thing.
Right.
Yeah.
My friend, a guy I grew up with, was his assistant for a while, and Harrison asked him, you know, come in the plane, I'll take you around, and he got on the plane and threw up in the plane.
That's kind of embarrassing, isn't it?
Yes, I think so.
Throwing up in Harrison Ford's plane.
That's right. That you want Harrison Ford to, you know, think you're cool.
Yeah, I don't think that probably does it.
That doesn't help.
So Han versus Han, this is a thing that's kind of followed this character.
Absolutely.
You have a line in the film where you correct Lando.
That's right, which is fun, yeah.
Because Billy Dee Williams famously was a Han man rather than
that's
a Han
right.
man, wasn't he?
And George Lucas is a Han man.
Is he? That I didn't know.
George Lucas, at least in my time with him and in interviews, has said Han, and Leia has said Han and Han.
Yeah.
But, you know, Harrison says Han and Harrison says Falcon, so that's, you know, that's if I'm him, that's what I'm saying.
But you've made it canonical now because you've corrected him.
That's right. Yeah, exactly. They kind of took that and made this joke of it. But you wonder how that went on in the original movies. I guess there's no one there kind of monitoring that stuff. They call her Leia. Some point. I mean, it's kind of, yeah.
They probably had other things to worry about.
They had other stuff to worry
about.
Like,
is this film going to work?
Right, exactly.
Like a giant dog man.
That's right.
Not 40 years from now will some guy on the internet be agonizing.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, imagine, you know, it's wild.
Now, one of the co-hosts of the Empire podcast is Helen, who has a long-time obsession with the long-running television show Supernatural. Now, you, I believe, are possibly the only guest we've ever had who has appeared on an episode
really?
Of Supernatural.
Really, yeah.
The 2005 true. Episode Wendigo, as I believe.
Yes, Wendigo.
Oh, sorry, Wendigo.
Well, don't apologize to me. I apologize
to Helen.
To Helen and all those Supernatural fans that you just offended.
What was that experience like?
It was great. That was my first ever job.
Really?
And I was 15 and I went to Vancouver for 2 weeks. And that was a real moment of like, I'd never been on a set before. And that was like a real... Also, it was the second episode of the whole season, of the whole show,
really?
Ever. So everyone had just gotten there. Now, I think they just finished that show very recently, so I'm sure this feeling was maybe different. But, you know, it was my first time on set, and it was this really kind of thrilling. I just remember that feeling of like, wow, I really love it here. I really love being – I love doing this. And it was – yeah, it was great. And I played Ben.
Did you get eaten by a Wendigo?
I didn't. My brother was kidnapped by a Wendigo,
right.
And we were worried. And I had one line where I said, like the Donner Party, and everyone at I was friends with for a long time said like the Donner Party and made fun of me constantly for that line. I don't know why.
I know Helen would want me to ask you, are Sam and Dean as dreamy as they appear?
Incredibly dreamy. Incredibly dreamy. They were probably my age. They might have been younger than me actually at that time, which is crazy to think about. But yeah, they were super, they were really fun guys and really nice. And it was a lot of fun.
Oh, she will be thrilled.
And there are certain shows that every actor seems to book on their way up.
CSI.
Yeah. You knew that was coming.
Yeah.
I don't know what you play in this. I just interviewed Adam Scott recently, and he was in an episode as well.
Oh, really?
But, what was your...
Well, in Supernatural, I was Ben, and in CSI, I played Sven. And I think I had a line where I said, I hate my father for naming me Sven. What was my experience on that? That was a lot quicker. I kind of went in and did a couple scenes, and I was... the son of Danny Bonaducci and Sean Young, and I was a suspect in a murder.
Okay, so Sven.
I was 16.
Right, but did you do it?
Did I do it? No, I didn't do the murder.
Okay, good.
No, I was innocent.
Acquitted.
I was acquitted.
Okay. Was this during the Grissom years? When Billy Peterson was on.
I don't. Oh yes.
Oh, it was.
Yes, yeah. It was. Yeah, he was there. Yeah. That's right.
Was it fun doing stuff like that when you were 15, 16? Because that's.
Supernatural was really fun because they all were just beginning it, and it was CSI was just kind of, you know, they had that routine down, and everyone is kind of, you're just like going through this kind of machine in a way, not to detract from the magic of that, but Supernatural was a lot longer, and we were in Stanley Park, and we were in nature, and we were shooting outside, and it was much more involved shoot, and so that was really, and it was with great people. David Nutter directed it, and he was really, that was another, he's a great director. He did a lot of the pilots for some of like or the greatest shows, and he was very encouraging of me, even though that was my first job and I had very little to do. At the end of it, actually, he kind of picked me up and in front of the whole crew and said to the whole crew, like, you're all going to be seeing this kid somewhere. And it was really special. He was really warm, and he said, trust your instincts.
And he turned out to be 100% right.
I guess so, yeah.
And on that note, thank you very much
thank
for joining
you.
Us.
Thank you. That was wonderful. Fun. Thanks.
It's been a pleasure.
Nice
thank
to meet you guys.
Well, that was Alden Ehrenreich. He seemed fun, James. Was that good fun?
He was loads of fun, actually. We had ages with him. We sat and talked about all kinds of stuff, most of which I'm sure didn't make it into this. But yes, we did. We did chat a bit about Supernatural.
Good.
He seemed to have very fond memories of Sam and Dean.
Well, don't we all?
Yeah,
really?
Yeah. He did. We didn't get onto the Wincest part of it.
Probably just as well.
Yeah.
I mean,
we would have done if we'd had time.
It's not canon. Let's be honest. Right, well, thank you for not talking Wincest, and if you don't know what that is, please don't look it up, for your sake, not for ours. Here, by the way, is our Chris Hewitt with a quick reminder of what to watch this week on Sky Movies.
Why, thank you, Helen, and yes, indeed, this segment is coming to you all the way from Los Angeles, the City of Angels, and while I may be thousands of miles from home, thanks to our good chums at Sky Cinema, I am never truly alone because I downloaded a bunch of films onto my iPad before I came out here. Always think ahead. Always be thinking. Sky Cinema are, of course, the sponsors of this week's show, and they have over 1,000 quality movies on demand for you to enjoy wherever and whenever you want. If, for example, jet lag strikes in the middle of the night and you can't get back to sleep and the British businessman next door to you is yelling into his phone at 4:30 in the morning for a good solid hour... watch some movies in Sky Cinema, but that's just a random example that has no relation to what is actually happening in my life. This week, my recommendations are War for the Planet of the Apes, which is a new addition to the premiere section of Sky Cinema. It is a premiere on Sky Cinema, the third and final part of the rebooted Planet of the Apes trilogy. This sees Andy Serkis on peerless form as Caesar, once again, the wise chimp who is leader of a large colony of apes in a world almost entirely devoid of humans. But humans lurk out there, and in the shape of Woody Harrelson's Colonel, they represent trouble for Caesar and his clan. Part road movie, part western, part POW movie, Matt Reeves' film is, for my money, the best of this new trilogy. It's thoughtful, it's elegiac, it's exciting, with wonderful effects and performances at its core. You will love Steve Zahn as Bad Ape. Go bananas, then, for War for the Planet of the Apes. Which shares a lot in common with a fellow Fox film, and it's another movie which brings the trilogy to a close. It's my second recommendation this week, and that is Logan, which is James Mangold and Hugh Jackman's farewell to the mutant the clawed mutant that Jackman has been playing for close to 2 decades now in almost 10 X-Men films. This is a far cry from X-Men Origins Wolverine, or indeed the Wolverine in terms of his solo outings. It's a somber, bleak, brutal affair set in the near future where mutants have been mostly wiped out, and Logan, now aging, struggling to stay one step ahead of the Grim Reaper, is looking after an aged Charles Xavier Stewart, not McAvoy, when a young girl with extraordinary abilities comes into his life, sparking one last shot at redemption. It's beautifully written, shot and performed. For my money, this violent modern western is the best there is at what it does. And if this is to be Jackman's farewell to the character, it's a damn good note on which to go out. And that's it for my Sky Cinema update from LA. I'm back in London next week. Join me then for more Sky Cinema related fun. Meanwhile, Helen, it's back to you in the studio.
All right, and it's time now for this week's movie reviews. First up, we have a film set in a desperate time, long ago and far away, about a young scrapper who must struggle to survive in a harsh environment. I refer, of course, to The Breadwinner.
See what you did there.
It's so good. Yes, so this is the new film from Cartoon Saloon, the people behind Song of the Sea and The Secret of Kells. 3 for 3 in Oscar nominations. I'm a little bit proud because they're Irish. I'm Irish. I'm taking all the credit. But of course, the credit actually belongs to director Nora Toomey, who does a fantastic job of adapting this book. And it's the story, it's set in Kabul in 2001. And it's about a young girl called Parwana, whose father is basically arrested by the Taliban and imprisoned. And she is left with her mother, her older sister, and a baby brother, which means they have no adult male to accompany them out of the house. You cannot leave your house as a woman under the Taliban without male family member accompanying you. So obviously leaves them in pretty dire straits. She basically cuts her hair, dresses as a boy, and goes out to earn a living for her family in this extremely harsh environment, of course risking arrest or worse herself, and trying to keep, you know, her entire family afloat on her 11-year-old shoulders. So in many ways it's a pretty hard story. You know, one review from Variety I think said if this was live action it would be unwatchable, it would be just too upsetting, too tough. And with the idea that the animation gives it, you know, just that little kind of magical sheen and just enough room to make it bearable.
So it's not something to take your kids to see?
I don't think you would take very young kids.
Yeah, because Song of the Sea is like a fun for all the family.
It is, but again, I mean, there's a huge emotional hit to that film as well.
Yeah, apart from when you're like crying for about 10 minutes after it ends.
Yeah. but no, it's probably a little bit older than either of their two previous films, but both of those films had scary moments and upsetting moments and selkies and so on. This one is like really tough just in terms of its honest depiction, I think, of that era in Afghanistan. But it is not without hope. It's not without humour. It's not without sort of some kind of faith in humanity, I think. And there are kind of magical moments. So she tells her little brother, her baby brother, a story. And it's kind of interesting because at the very beginning of the film, her dad's trying to tell stories to her, and she's like, "Oh, we've got no time for stories. The world is too hard. I can't be having with all of this. We need to concentrate on what's real." And it's interesting that as her life becomes harder, she needs that kind of escape into fiction. I think that's a really good kind of message, one of the many messages from the film. But I think it's just wonderful. The character of Parwana is just one of the great heroines, I think, of the modern age. I think she's just great, voiced by, I think it's Sarah Choudhury, and she's wonderful. Really good voice cast all over. Not a, you know, starry big name voice cast, but just that they do really, really good work. And it's beautifully done, I think. I really, really liked it. We gave it 4 stars, and it deserves, I think, at least that many. So The Breadwinner is very much
it's upsetting, isn't it, Helen, when a film that should get a higher rating gets savaged by the person who reviews it, who unjustly removes a star when it clearly should be there.
Almost as upsetting as somebody who harps on about a film which is clearly 3 stars, deserving more. All right, let's go into our next film. It is time now to talk about a film, a story about someone who must go through real trials to become the person that they were always meant to be. And by that, of course, I refer to Sheila Hancock in Edie.
Yeah, so we've got a review of this online
So you can go and read that. But according to our reviewer, so this is about Edie, who is in her 80s and her husband has passed away, played by Sheila Hancock, as you mentioned.
Husband's played by Sheila Hancock.
Huh?
The husband
is in a in a surprise twist. So Edie is played by Sheila Hancock, and her character in her younger years always intended to climb a Scottish mountain. Swilven. We are all going to look at each other and pretend like we know how to
pronounce that.
A Scottish mountain. She was always intending to climb it with her father, but then when she got married to a very traditionalist man, those plans got put on hold. So after her husband passes away, she decides that now is the time to try and conquer the Scottish wildlands. And but with her being in her older years, she's not really prepared to take on that journey alone. So she teams up with a young guy called Johnny, played by Kevin Guthrie, and they basically go up the mountain together. And they're sort of kind of mismatched odd couple who learn different life lessons from each other along the way on this journey.
And then
journey.
They're stalked by wolves, and the two of them have to hunt the wolves to their lair, and she gets some minibar bottles and tapes them to her fist, and she fights the wolves.
Yes, and then Liam Neeson comes out of the woods, and they team up together and punch the wolves, and that's the end.
This is essential viewing. I think everyone should watch it.
Obviously none of that happens. But according to our reviewer, the premise is great, and apparently the character of Edie herself is really formidable, and it's an amazing performance from Sheila Hancock. But the film around it is less interesting than you would hope for from that dynamic, and it kind of seems to go for easier, gentler beats rather than the kind of more promising emotional depth that you would hope for from that premise. So two stars for this one.
Okay. Bit disappointing that, but time now to go on to a better film, one that touches on the younger days of an iconic, nay, legendary figure. I'm referring, of course, to civil rights campaigner Rosa Parks, who plays a role in the documentary The Rape of Recy Taylor. Now, we haven't got the review for this up on the website yet, but I can tell you it's a documentary about the rape in 1944 of a black woman in Alabama, and it discusses basically the sort of the unfairness of the situation and the absolute lack of justice that she received, despite the efforts of the NAACP, who sent down their investigator, Rosa Parks, to try and help her, who got behind her. There was a huge outswell of support for her in her community, and yet she still couldn't get an indictment of the men responsible, even though they admitted, some of them, to the crime. They still weren't indicted for
That's
it. So
insane.
It's an absolute howl of injustice, this film, and it sort of draws a line from the mistreatments under slavery right through the civil rights era and beyond, and it's a really powerful piece, and it sort of stands next to Ava DuVernay's The 13th, I think, in terms of its, you know, linking up of the past and showing the sort of the continuation of the injustices of slavery into something more like the present day. So a little bit heavy-handed at times, I think, especially in its music choices, but definitely a really upsetting, powerful film and powerful story. Also out this week, there is the story, of course, of a man who stood up to an entire empire from his place in a remote colony, which is Zama. That's had great reviews at festivals around the world, so do check that out. And is that all?
I think that's everything. Yeah. I think we're done with reviews for that. Oh, there's a Star Wars film.
Oh, yeah.
There's a Star Wars
there
film.
There is. There's a film about the younger days of Han Solo.
Helen, it's Han Solo.
Han Solo. It's funny. Some of my intros might have misled you there. I apologise if there was any confusion.
Something Alden Ehrenreich revealed is obviously they've now made canon that you have to pronounce it Han. But George Lucas pronounces it Han. So I don't know where we all stand at this point. I'm very confused.
Well, let's talk about the film, then.
Let's talk about the film. So this is the second Star Wars anthology movie, which is The Younger Days of Han Solo, who grew up as a street rat on the slums of Corellia before running into the Sultan's daughter and pretending to be a Sultan himself, courting her, and then the evil vizier turns up and his... That's Aladdin. But it's a lot like that, except it's set in space. It's an interesting film. It's a Western in many ways. It's a sort of has a frontier vibe to it.
And I'm not really going to talk about the story because I just think it's almost incidental. It's about a character. It's about him. It's about him meeting Chewie and forming that bond. It's about him becoming the person that we encounter in A New Hope, going from, you know, the street rap to the kind of sardonic, cynical smuggler that we all know and love. And I had, as I've said many times, enormous concerns about this film, which were mainly allayed, actually. Alden Ehrenreich is extraordinarily good.
He is very good, yeah.
He's fantastic, and I think to step into Harrison Ford's shoes, that's no mean feat. Mm-hmm. And he really pulls it off, and it's not mimicry, it's not imitation, but you feel Ford there from the, you know, the pointing finger of doom to. He has the kind of squinty, sardonic kind of smile thing going on.
He's got the body language.
He
just
does.
Down.
Yeah, he really does. And I really enjoyed this. It's a light film. It's not dark. Like, the tone is quite, you know, buoyant. It's really enjoyable. There's some great characters. L3, played by Phoebe Waller-Bridge, who I have christened C-Fleepio, is fantastic. Really enjoyed her in this. Donald Glover is fantastic as Lando Calrissian.
Mm-hmm. And this is really important to note, an entire wardrobe full of cloaks. Nothing else.
Yeah.
There are no other visible clothes. So maybe he has a wardrobe for all his shirts as well, but like,
there are moments of this where it feels a little bit like if you were Robot Chicken writing a parody, you might literally copy some of these scenes word for word. But it walks that line very, very well. It is funny, it's exciting, it's full of daring do and swashbuckling adventure. I had loads of fun with it. I think, and I tried to explain this to someone who's, oh, you know, Harrison Ford is Han Solo, you can't pull it. I was like, think of this as the Kelvin timeline Star Wars movie. You know, don't let it bleed into the canonical Star Wars. Don't worry about where it fits in. Don't worry about, he doesn't look like Harrison. It doesn't matter. Think of it as an alternate timeline and appreciate it as a Star Wars romp that you get as a kind of palate cleanser before Episode 9. Don't take it too seriously. Go in without expectation. You really enjoy yourself. We gave this one 4 stars. And yeah, I do recommend people go and see it.
Yeah, it's good to see. It's always good to see Chewie on the big screen.
Yeah, it is. It is. I got a hug from Chewie.
Oh,
so jealous of that.
I did. He came in for the junket. He was on site in all his glory, and me and Nick got hugs, and Chris couldn't get a hug because he was still editing last week's podcast, and he wasn't very happy. Sorry, Chris. Chewie said hi. The guy in the costume, who is, in fact, the guy in the costume, it wasn't Eunice, it was the stunt Wookiee, the mm-hmm. stunt Chewie. And he was in there, and he'd been in there a while, and I said to him, I said, oh, is it hot in there? And he just went, So he had the sounds down. And I think I appreciate that level of commitment to the character.
That is what you need to play.
Interestingly, and I think Ehrenreich touches on this in the interview, it's made of yak hair, the costume, but they shampoo it regularly because obviously otherwise it's going to stink. And Chewie smelled very fragrant and he was soft and fluffy. So, you know, that's a fact you should all have.
I always knew it somehow. Mm. I always knew it. Do you know Princess Leia had a baby Wookiee doll growing up? You know, it just seems to chime with that somehow.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah. Well, I think that is all for this week's Empire Podcast, brought to you by Sky Cinema. Join us next week for more film-related fun, when we'll be joined by Martin Freeman to talk about his new Netflix show, Cargo. We will also be doing Solo, A Star Wars Story spoiler special. And
we
try saying
indeed.
That 2 times fast. We will have a spoiler special for Solo, A Star Wars Story. And God, there's a lot of syllables there. Coming for you, but we're holding that for another couple of weeks, so it will not be out on Monday, but do keep an eye out on the Empire website, on the Twitter and Facebook feeds. It will be coming your way. And until the main podcast next week, that is it from me. It's goodbye from James.
Goodbye.
Goodbye from Ben.
Goodbye.
And it's goodbye from me. I am off to kill all handle jokes with an axe.
You need to get a grip, Helen, on the handle.
Dead me. Thanks very much, guys. Goodbye.